than there were people that were becoming more enlightened, protesting. The great political protest in the 60s, there was a lot of people in America that did that, but most of the youth stayed outside of that.
Right.
And so I was
no,
thinking
you're right about what
that.
You said before that, though. You know, I mean, you said my generation, you know, like,
yeah, I'm just,
they are, you know, I mean, I hate to say it, but it is that we are in a mess because of, you know, I mean.
We're in a mess because of the educated and elite.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones that fucked it all up. It wasn't the poor. And the middle class, they're too, it's like the Roman times, bread and circuses. They're too distracted with their own bullshit
right.
to even give a damn. They got a cottage, whoopee. They don't think about anything else. You see some of these bourgeois people on Facebook, and they're going, oh, off to Florida. Oh, we came back. We're going, you know,
right.
Fuck you. Who gives a shit that, you know, you wiped your ass? I don't care.
Yeah, there's a lot of that on there. There's a lot of that.
It's
and the thing now is disturbing, I think, is that in my generation, people, you know, in their late 20s, up to, you know, even in early 40s, there is not really, like, there's no one protesting the Iraq war. Not like they did the Vietnam War. And there's no one saying, I mean, there are, and I'm one of those few people, but the amount of us in my generation standing up and saying, hey, man, 9/11 looks like it was an inside job. Hey, man, the same guys that fucked the economy, Congress is saying, writing blank checks to the same guys.
Absolutely.
There's no one doing that. I mean, there are, like, I'm me, but there's... It's such a subculture now.
It's very small. I interviewed Joni McCoy. She'd be a good one to interview. She's with the Peace and Something Alliance. She knows some of our old counterculture people. Who was that gal that was on the city council? She ended up in Boston. She was arrested and put in jail. Sister Arth Platt. Joni's been over to Iraq. I mean, she's part of the peace movement. And is it Monday? They're on the corner by the courthouse with their signs up, you know, against the war. And on Fridays, they're over on Tip of the West.
Oh, okay.
Over by...
How would I get in touch with her? And she's...
I think I have a phone number because I interviewed... In the same article, I interviewed Joan McCoy and John Sinclair.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And Joni's... She's cool. She's... And they have a film night at the library. I think it's in the township library.
I saw that. They're doing
Joan McCoy and that.
Okay, because they're showing some good films.
They're showing great films.
And I thought about contacting them to say, what about this film? Because I'm a documentary freak.
They're a good bunch, but they're small.
Right.
They're small.
Well, I'd go out of my way to help them grow.
And Joan just her husband is like a retired lawyer, and Joni, you know, she stands for these principles, and her kids are bourgeois, right? They
right.
grew up in Santa Township. They don't believe in what she's doing, so
right.
she has balls.
Well,
she still does. Still loves her kids.
She needs some support.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this. I was talking the other day to somebody, and it was actually Gina, and she was talking about this guy named Lanny, who runs this shop called Lanny Land.
He was the bass player of the Bossmen. The Beatles. They were the Beatles to us. He was incredibly talented. He would play, turn the volume up and play with one hand and then do the trumpet in the other.
So he was a musician?
Yes.
Okay.
He was a good one at the time.
Because he runs his shop on the east side now.
Oh, it's still... Because
he
I wonder where he went.
He was downtown.
Yeah.
And then he moved... Oh, well, he moved further east, or further... would this be south?
Yeah.
He moved this way, down Washington.
He's still in Washington?
No.
Oh, did he move back in that? Because he was originally in that really terrible area of Washington.
He's
back there? Because that's where his shop originally was.
Michigan's right here. Hamilton's right
here.
And
see, he has all these Bossman 45s that are like you can't find anywhere. And I bought a bunch of those from him.
Well, I'm thinking about interviewing him next.
Lanny has mental health issues?
Yeah, that's what... Gina said there's a sign on his door that says no schizophrenics.
He's a nice man but doesn't trust.
Right.
He has a 45 Warren Keith, who was the piano player for the Bossmen and a great singer. He sounded like Elvis. Or, And he'd do a Jerry Lee thing. He set his piano on fire. He ended up as a piano player for Hank Williams Jr., Warren Keith. And he has a 45 of Warren in the studio just playing his piano and singing a ballad. And he had a great voice. He won't show that to anybody. I just wanted to hear it. He wouldn't let me hear it.
When was the last time you saw him?
Several years ago. He was part of... I was part of that... I was like the roadie there in... Was it 94? There was a Michigan rock and roll reunion, and it had Dick Wagner Frost, the Boss Men, the Rationals, and so on. And Lanny played and did a great job. That was his really his last claim to fame.
Gina told me... there was a rumor that when the power will go out in the building, and where his landing land was, it's just like a everything shop, like a flea market.
Oh, I've been there. Oh, yeah.
He said
I bought stuff.
She heard rumors that when the power went out, he'd get up on the roof with his gun and look, just keep watch.
Well, it could be. He was a little bit paranoid. I mean, he wouldn't. I mean, like Pete Woodman has a shrine. According to Sue White, because I've never been to Pete's home. Pete's played White's Bar in recent years, but he has all this Boston stuff, and he tried to talk Lanny into letting him have a copy of the Warren Keith song because it's so incredibly rare. And Lanny wouldn't talk to him. Lanny's daughter worked at the bakery across the street, and his ex-wife. She'd be interesting to talk to. She was a go-go girl, and she gave me pictures. She was beautiful, blonde hair, just gorgeous body. And she has that bookstore by Jack's Fruit Market on Bay Road.
Oh, yeah. It's still there? It's in that little strip, yeah.
Yeah, I forget her name now. I think it has her name on the title of the store, but she's friendly and knows the history. She might be interesting to interview if you do interview Lanny. But they were, I mean, that was Dick Wagner had like three bands or so before he ever got the Saginaw. But that was Dick Wagner's big Saginaw band, the Bossmen. Great band, loved them. I heard them at Daniel's Den, and they played the grand opening of Montgomery Ward's record store, and I saw that there was Go-Go Girls on either side and Cages, and Mark Farner was in the band at the time from Grand Funk. He was in the Bossmen, and they put on a great show. It was during the afternoon. Montgomery Ward's is where it's down Genesee right before he got to the bridge. That's where Montgomery Ward's used to be.
Okay.
On the right hand side as you're going east into the downtown area. And now there's Reuben Daniels and that.
Right. And the little children's museum. And
I told you. Angelo Lorenzo would come into White's Bar. He had a couple big hits, but the one I remember now is Sleepy Time Gal. And he'd come in, and if he got enough beers in him, he'd play harmonica and lead everybody in a sing-along that included some of his hits, like Sleepy Time Gal, which was a big hit in the 40s. But he was highly coveted just as a projectionist for Daniel's Theater, which was next door, and that became Daniel's Den. But the Franklin Theater downtown and so on. The Temple Theater, that was a going theater. And so music was always part of White's Bar. My grandpa didn't like music, and
He didn't like music.
He was pissed at
I always find it funny when people don't like music.
Yeah. He was an old curmudgeon, my grandpa. He and I didn't get along. And I'm going to probably write this piece in the history because I left it out because I didn't know about it. But I was a kind of hyperactive kid. And I'd go to his house, 2281 North Carolina. It was a brick house built especially for him, and it was like a model home, and it was in the paper. Mm-hmm. So I used the profile on it. But I'd go in there, and Nana had all her knickknacks, and I'd bump into him, break him. And I would cut his lawn, and he didn't like the way I cut it. I swear he hit me once, one of those. But what happened, what I found out from my mom, when she was dying, I spent a lot of time at her house. I cared for her, I stayed at night, And she was telling me how grandpa really favored my brother Bill. And she says, I didn't like it. I thought it was wrong. And he'd take him fishing and other things, and he never asked you to go. And she was saying it not so much to get me upset, but the idea was, you're my favorite, though. You know,
right.
One of those things. But so I had that in my history, that it was always an undercurrent.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that helped create that feeling like I'm an outsider. Like, I had this kind of basic mistrust of the world, but in doing some of my internal work, what happened, I had an enlarged thymus gland, and nobody knew it at the time. And just as a baby, you know, and my mom would put me down, and then I couldn't breathe. I started screaming, crying, I was choking, and I turned blue. She had to put me back up, and she'd tell my father about it. He says, oh, I'll talk to my mom, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so my nana said, she's just a nervous mom. She doesn't know what she's doing. It'll be okay. But then it wasn't, and I kept on choking, and,
mm-hmm.
and my life was at risk. Finally, my dad saw that I couldn't breathe and turning blue, and he took me to the hospital. He was working all the time. That's what you do when you go to White's Bar. You know, you're
right.
working all the time. And I used to work, you know, double shifts all the time at White's Bar. But he finally saw it, took me to the hospital, and they did this X-ray kind of laser. It wasn't laser, but X-ray kind of treatment. And it solved the problem. Years later, when I was around 21, they said that could cause cancer. So they checked me out for cancer and didn't find anything. But because I look at that, when you think of just a little baby and you can't breathe and you're not getting much relief, that's traumatizing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to Eric Erickson's Stages of Man, that, you know, the first 3 years, or first 5 years, is like basic trust versus mistrust,
mm-hmm.
Autonomy versus shame and doubt, initiative versus guilt. So I think that kind of got distorted by that experience I had as a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not a guy that naturally just goes out, this is a good guy, or I like that.
Right.
I have to, I don't trust anyone.
Yeah. I'm just skeptical of everybody and everything.
Yeah, I'm kind of a skeptic. But, you know, and it's... Jim Perkins told me this. He's a nice fellow. He's a talented guy. But he came by when I was up on the sign. We're talking. I said, well, you know, do you ever think about starting My Dog Bob, that band up again? Or putting a group together. He says, no, not really. You know, he says, well, I don't like people. So it's hard for him to form a group. I go, you know what? And then I started using that. I don't like people. But I actually do. But
it's hard.
It's hard.
Because you do, but you don't a lot.
Yeah.
You know, there's no really other way of saying it.
Yeah, it's a paradox, but it makes sense. I mean, it's like... And it could be something like being born with a certain type of temperament, which is intrinsic, like a slow to warm temperament, as opposed to a real easy trusting temperament,
right.
Versus a very difficult temperament where you're raised in hell as a baby.
Yeah.
So I might have been slow to warm too.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, what about the people who are born trusting everyone? You know, they get walked on a lot, and they get screwed over a lot, and they have to learn. It takes them a lot longer to learn things, I think.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to attachment, the attachment relationship where parents teach co-regulation of affect and help teach your baby to calm down,
mm-hmm.
by going there. You know,
right.
There's some families that say don't pick up a baby when they're crying,
right.
because that spoils them. That's exactly wrong. You got to pick them up, and the more you do that consistently, the less the baby cries later.
Right.
In their development.
Well, they're not at a stage where their brain's able to think, well, if I cry, then I'm going to get something. They're not thinking that, so picking them up is the only real solution, I think.
And it's a hardwired response by
mm-hmm.
us as parents.
Right.
As a species, when we hear our young in distress, we go to them.
Right.
If all things are right.
Yeah.
But they're not always right. And one thing that happens in helping our kids grow, If we have a good secure attachment, there's social learning theory, Bandura social learning theory, and our kids take their cue from us. So a stranger knocks on the door, we open the door, our kid is there, and we go, "Hi, how you doing?" Then the kid's okay. If,
mm-hmm.
if we're uptight about it, then they stand off. It's like when the families ask me, should I take my 3-year-old to the funeral, my 2.5-year-old? Well, yes, you should.
Mm-hmm.
They want to know, once kids have language, they want to know what's going on. They want to know the truth. And so you do take them to the funeral and you behavioralize what death is.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to the funeral and everybody's raising hell, it's dramatic death or whatever, and people are screaming and crying and fighting, you don't take a kid.
Right.
Because that'll freak a kid out.
Yeah, and give them the wrong impression of what that's all about.
Yeah. And so you get a securely attached kid, they're not going to walk off with a stranger.
Right.
Because they've learned that from the parents. So they would give you a chance. But as they see their parent relax, they would relax, and they might finally come up to you.
Right. Interesting. That's what you do, though, right?
Yeah, that's what I do. Yes.
I could talk about poems all day.
Yeah. I hope to come and see your show. What time is it? It's next Friday?
Yeah, it's Friday. I think it starts at 7. People can start getting in, sitting down around 7. I'm hoping we have a decent turnout. Last month there was a pretty well-known Michigan poet, so it was packed.
How many people can sit?
Oh, they could probably fit 30, 40, maybe 45 in there.
Is that Court?
Yeah, Court Street Gallery. It's not right above Adamitis, but it's to the left, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Tom, thanks for